The following is a recording of a seminar I gave in November 1994 on discipleship in the family, and it covers pretty much parenting in the first 10 years. It is accompanied by a handout, which would be good for you to have, that gives you the visuals and the verses and everything on what will be covered. So here's the seminar.
As you come to study anything, or to undertake anything, one of the main questions is, particularly when it costs you time that you don't have a whole lot of, is why should I even be doing this? Some of you ask that question when you're sitting there in church, bored out of your mind at times. It could be when you're in school. Maybe that was what you thought almost every day during your school career. What am I doing here? What good is this? And as we come to this issue of child raising or discipleship in the family, and we talk about spending a whole morning together, we first need to deal with why should we even bother. The first reason might be in order to be better parents. Secondly, in order to be a better aunt. Maybe you're not a parent, but you just still are going to be relating to children that you related to you physically as an aunt, uncle, a grandparent. And third, in order to be more effective in working with children in the church, one of the signs that we really are the kingdom of God is how we include children, not just in terms of activities, but in terms of our heart. Every true believer, as they grow more and more Christ-like, will be more and more receptive to children, not just their own children. We're already naturally receptive to a certain degree to our own children. But as we grow in grace, I believe one of the things that God is wanting to do is also open our heart, make more room in our heart for the least, the little, the last, and the lost, and particularly those that we don't have any ulterior motive behind. It's just that they're a little one and that I belong to Jesus Christ. And so my heart goes out to them. And fourth, in order to do a better job with our commitment to the children who have been baptized or dedicated in our congregation, we all make that kind of promise, you know, that we never know what it is we're actually going to do about that. But when they dedicate a child, well, y'all going to whatever it is they say you're going to do. And talking about these principles of child raising, even for the single person that doesn't have a child, will open up a new level of understanding for them about how they can participate with the little ones in their own congregation. After talking about why is it an important topic, we'd like to discuss what's the goal, what's the point. What are we aiming at? It's very difficult to have a sense of progress if you don't know where you're going. Were they making progress in the desert for 40 years? Well, not really, because we know where they were supposed to be going. They were supposed to be going to the Promised Land. If their only goal had been to get out of Egypt, then I guess you could have said they were progressing. But they weren't really going to anywhere. They were just leaving somewhere. We need to know where are we heading? What are we looking for to be approaching as we give ourselves to being better parents? And I put here, our goal is not necessarily to be successful, as defined in that all of our children will be pastors, vibrant Christians, internationally reclaimed and known speakers on the Christian faith, or even just church going. That cannot be our goal. Why? Because it is outside of our control. That child will decide their own destiny, whether or not they will respond. And so to have that as my goal will only frustrate me, because whenever you have a goal that's not related to anything, something you can control, then you just have to watch it happen, and it's sort of like, you know, rolling the dice, because it's not something that you can control. Even God, who has many children, is not always successful. Look at how some of His kids turn out. So, I mean, who do you think you are? We're not any better than God. And in Hebrews it says, God says, all day long I've held out my hands to a stubborn and obstinate people, but they didn't want to respond. So as parents also, we can't be sure that our children will respond at any point in time. But our goal should be to be found faithful. To be found faithful. Would someone like to look up Luke 16:10 and read that for us?
Luke 16:10, whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much. And whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much.
The one that can be trusted with little, in this case a little person, can be trusted with much. God is going to look at how faithful were we in fulfilling our trust. So we're to be faithful, but faithful in what? What is it we're supposed to do? What's the way we're to go? As the disciples were saying, well, how do we get there? What's the way to the Father? And Jesus answered, you know, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. The path or the way in child raising is to imitate God. God is the only perfect parent. And as we focus on Him, rather than the way our parents raised us or what's presented in our culture, we can trust that we'll become more loving, more communicative, that we'll learn reconciliation, patience, self-control, sacrifice, discipline. God is a self-revealing God. A lot of parents don't reveal who they really are to their children. Things like that. As we focus on God, and as it says in Ephesians 5:1, be imitators of God and walk in love, just as Christ also loved you. We'll grow in His love. Now, some of these things I'm going to move through rather quickly because unlike the believers in Argentina, you have a little bit more of a biblical basis. So, and we have 6 weeks' worth of material we're going through in just a couple of hours. So we'll try to move along. I won't rush it, but I will try not to belabor points that probably you can get on your own. So I'm not going to cover everything that's spoken about here. I want to do this seminar because if we don't have a good testimony with our family, before the church and before the world, then we don't have a good testimony. I mean, that is part of our witness. With our lips we speak, but with our lives we shout. And you've all experienced that firsthand. And your children are experiencing it right now, maybe even this morning. Maybe you said certain things, but the way you acted communicated something very different. Yes, I love you. Please be quiet. I'm busy now. If you just looked at a transcript of that, an abbreviated one that said, yes, I love you, you wouldn't pick up what that life had communicated by tone of voice and by action. With our lips we speak, but with our lives we shout. And that's why I believe Jesus, when He started off the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5, He speaks to that quality of life and attitude, heart attitude. Blessed is the parent who is poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed is the parent who mourns, who's meek. Blessed is the mother, the father, who's a peacemaker, who can suffer for righteousness' sake. Here I do all of these things for you, and what thanks do I get? The one who rejoices in suffering. The home can be a place of tremendous suffering, even if you do everything right. Why? Because you've reproduced after your own kind. You're a sinner. You have reproduced a sinner. The only problem is he doesn't have all the benefit of training and help and good examples. He's starting off. He's in the raw form. And so you will suffer. You will suffer for righteousness' sake many times. You will have worked your fingers to the bone, been up all night, and then He knocks the porridge on the floor. Right? When you were ready to, you were busy, you had to be someplace at a certain time, it was Sunday, you had to be there with a smile on your face, and now you just had the kitchen carpeted and there's porridge upside down sinking in. Oatmeal. So it's very important for us to put it in practice in our lives because that is our testimony. God's form of communication, and this isn't in your notes, but God's method of communication is the incarnation. And God has presented Himself to us primarily as a Father. So the primary way that we communicate day by day the gospel is the degree to which we model in our family the fatherhood, the parenthood of God with our children. incarnation. Let's look at the child. If you look at your drawing there, I didn't translate the thing on his head, on his hat, the baby's hat. It's supposed to be General Nuisance, is what's on his little hat there. If you want to write that in, Leo is Mess. And so I've got General Mess General in Spanish. Let's look quickly at these verses. Genesis 1:26 is a very familiar verse where God created man. Let's notice two words. Let us make man in our image according to our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea, etc. In our image, according to our likeness. Whose image? Whose likeness? You can tell me. God. Who was created in God's image? Man, particularly Adam and Eve. But let's look over in Genesis 5:3, the second point, in the image of Adam. When Adam had lived 130 years, he became the father of a son in his own likeness, according to his image, and named him Seth. It doesn't say he had a son in the image and likeness of God. He had a son in the image and likeness of Adam. This was after Genesis 3 and the fall with the fruit and the serpent. When you had a child, that child had something of the image of God. But that child was born in your likeness and your image. And you know the trouble you've had doing what you ought to do. Responding to God, giving thanks, rejoicing, being obedient, being pure. And you have reproduced after your own kind. There is no other way. And so not only are there things that are reminiscent of the image of God, a desire for truth, righteousness, a love of beauty, but he's also in the image of his parents, sinner by nature, corrupted, flawed, even though they've not, when they're very tiny, it's not as though they've learned how to do it. You know, lie well, steal well. You know, they have these stumbling attempts at the beginning as they start off their life of crime. Stealing a penny, slapping somebody else who grabbed their toy. You catch them with their hand in the cookie jar. Johnny, what are you doing? Nothing, Mom. Their lies are very transparent at the beginning. But as we go on, we learn to perfect it. Because we're not only in the image of God, we're also in the image of man. So the child is a sinner. A sinner from birth, we won't look at it, but you know the passage, in sin my mother conceived me, in Psalms 51:5. And fourth, let's look at Proverbs 29:15. As a sinner, a child needs restriction. Freedom is one of the most difficult things to live with, absolute freedom. Absolute freedom, absolute power to control your life, some have said, corrupts absolutely. The rod and reproof give wisdom, but a child who gets his own way brings shame to his mother. How many have ever known a child who got his own way always? Anybody ever seen children get their own way? Nobody? Never in your home, but in the grocery store. Those other parents in the church.
Who should be here.
That's right. But that's why we're taping it. A child needs restriction. The conclusion, the child is neither an angel nor a demon. The child is a sinner who needs help spiritually. When they behave badly, they are simply acting according to their sinful nature. Sin is not excusable, even for a sinner, but it is understandable. And because of Jesus, we can share with them the way to victory, so that they don't have to be slaves of sin all their lives. I hope you get this point. The tendency, not so much here, but very much so in a Catholic culture, is to view a child as innocent. They've been baptized, no more original sin, they're just as clean and white, and they have those little invisible wings and the little halo. But then that child begins to act out of character. They begin to act like a little demon, yelling, throwing things, spitting, slapping. And so the parent begins to get more and more angry. Why? Because this angel is acting like a demon. And that must not be. So you try to slap them back into shape. If we realize and accept that this child, through no fault of their own, has been created in my imperfect image, that their natural estate is to live according to their lusts, even though that because they have also the image of God, they're not happy doing it. That's nevertheless their tendency. If I accept that my child is a sinner, that will reduce my level of anger when he acts normal. It is normal for a sinner to rebel, to say no, to be mean, to be selfish, to yell and scream when they don't get their own way, to only want the things that taste good, not the things that are good, and to not care about the truth or your feelings or how hard you work today and how much you'd like to take a nap, and they won't be quiet. When they act like a sinner, they are simply acting according to their nature. And who did they get that from? So that should help us calm down and realize when that child sins, they are being normal. If I don't like them being a sinner, then it is my task and my spouse's task to help that child learn to live in victory. I will be happier. They will be happier. God will be happier. It's all revealed in this book, How to Help Sinners. But we've got to surrender the idea, I'll get to you, that the child is an angel who sometimes has a split personality and is acting like a demon. He's just a sinner who needs help. Yes, Wendy?
And also, to at that point when I see my child, maybe it's out of doesn't have control or something, to stop and think, you know, well, what's the problem? Well, he that lacks self-control. And to take that opportunity to look at me, well, is that in me? You know, is he reproducing after me? What do I not have control in? Well, I slept for 3 hours too long this morning instead of getting up, you know, or whatever it may be. And to first realize, see the log in my own eye before I start trying to get my kid to do what he's supposed to do. Because the Lord has used that so much in my life, in our lives, to rebuke us or to correct us just by first seeing it in our child.
I have the blessing of having had an aunt who was a psychologist, one of the early birds and the breaking into the psychology field as a woman. Back, I think she graduated in 1920 or so, and she was not a Christian for most of her life. She 6 months before she died, she came to Christ in 1972, I think it was. But as her life drew to a close, I chatted with her one day. She was lying in her bed, and she was very discouraged. And she said, "I wonder if I have failed." Now, no one has ever worked more wonderfully with children. Children could come in there that were so distraught and yelling and upset, and the parents upset. And she would spend a couple of hours with that child, and they would just be gentle as a lamb. She could always help the children, but she found that every time and she would talk with the parents, but every time the child would get back with the parents, everything would revert as it was before, even with years of therapy. And she reached the conclusion at the end of her life, you cannot help children without the parents changing. The problem with psychology is the kind of clients you get are the ones that want to solve all their problems with money rather than transformation of their own life. They want you to, the problem must be in the child, and the solution is pay a specialist to do something about it. But the key to your child is what God can do in you. That is the key. It's almost unheard of for there ever really to be a problem child. It is always a problem parent. That's encouraging, isn't it? Sorry about that.
I think I'm the best my house.
Well, let's move along. That's too convicting. Ages. Let's run quickly through the different ages of a child. It's very important for us to realize that children are not adults. When a child is always treated as an adult, he will always act like a child. I'm going to say that again. It's not in your notes. When a child is always treated as an adult, he will always tend to act like a child or in a childish way. The first stage is the baby. The baby starts with total dependency, especially dependent on the mother. He develops insecurity through affection, attention, and the care he receives from his parents. It's very important to demonstrate love by physical touch and loving words. When he begins to walk, he enters the next stage, as you very well know. It's so important to hold little babies. Not just when they have cried out, but just to get with them as much as you can. They need you. They need to hear you speaking to them. They need to see you looking at them. It's the way you communicate how God is always looking at us, how He's speaking to us, how He's loving us, even when we do so many things wrong. There is a wealth of emotional strength that you communicate to in the first year of life. I say that particularly for dads, because dads tend to think, well, once he gets, you know, not so fragile, then my turn kicks in. You know, here's a football. But it is so important for the father to be with that child. If the father is not with his baby, that communicates to the child. And you think, well, how can that child know anything? That child knows an awful lot more than you have any idea, even though they can't communicate yet. They're probably learning at a more rapid rate in the first 2 years than at any other time in their life. They're just a sponge soaking it all in. You just don't get a whole lot of echo, so you think, well, it's just a blank wall there. But it's not. And when the father is distant those first 2 years, he's communicating that God, when you become a brand new baby Christian, He doesn't care a thing about you the first 2 years. You've got to get some Bible knowledge. You've got to get to Bible school. Then maybe God will throw the football with you. God loves His newborn babies. He is a father. The father also needs to be with that baby. But then they begin to walk. And you thought you had troubles. You find out your house, you look at your house a completely different way. If there's anything left of it. You begin moving things and placing things out of reach. In this stage, the child tries to establish himself as the only authority in his life. Can you relate to that? You can expect that he will fight against and reject any restriction of his freedom. He will be governed by his own desires, looking only to satisfy himself. This is the stage where the majority of his behavior patterns will be established. Respect for authority and others' rights, honesty, patience, self-control, study and work, interest in others, contentment. And this really by age 10. By age 10. Much of the way, probably 80% of their way of being in all these areas has already been pretty much established. Now God is gracious. And it's a good thing we're with Him. Because God can even start when somebody's 80 years old and do great things. So your kid isn't 80 years old yet. So don't lose hope by any means. But also, don't underestimate how important that period of life is in the child's life. It's very normal for the child to say no, to reject authority, because that is the basic nature of a sinner. And he got that from you. Third stage, stage of youth, and these are very broad terms, you know, but this is pre-puberty and beyond that, puberty. adolescence. This is the stage of the development of their individual personality. They're developed already kind of as an individual, but this is in the sense of an individual with a little, but they begin taking distance from the family in order to figure out, who in the world am I? And it's innate, and it's God's way of preparing them to eventually live separated from that family unit, geographically and emotionally. Their sexuality becomes more important. There is a greater need to understand the why behind the rules that they obey. They are allowed more privileges, but at the same time, they receive greater responsibilities. There's a greater need for role models, acceptance, recognition as individuals. If they didn't learn respect and obedience in their childhood, you can expect rebellion and rejection toward parents from them as youth. The parent that thinks, well, it's rough now, but it's going to get better, are in for a bad surprise. Unless it gets better now, it's going to be worse then. You sow the wind, you reap the whirlwind. If that child does not learn self-control when he's still small enough for you to take him by the hand and make him go to his room because he's going to go to his room, when he is taller than you and weighs 50 pounds more than you, you have had it. You can no longer force compliance when they get big. And finally, as in the fourth stage, adult, completely responsible for their own conduct before God and society. Time is running out. And no, you will not always have to suffer having that child around. But that child will always have to suffer who he is. And you're the one. You're his discipler. So many parents just focus on getting that Bible knowledge in there. The kid's about to explode with Bible knowledge. But he has no idea how to live in victory over sin. He lives with constant sense of guilt, estrangement to his parents, and defeat. We need to have the vision of training that child to live the victorious Christian life. Any questions? Number 5 is not on there. Hang on. The training. This is what you will do by the grace of God. In fact, you're doing it however well or however poorly. You are training your child. He's not looking to anybody else. He's receiving some from the TV, maybe some from the world. But in the first 10 years of life, the one who leaves the elephant footprint on his life is mom and dad. Someone said, you're either a good witness or a bad witness for Christ. But you are a witness. And you are training your child. It begins with the parents administering the external controls necessary and ends up with the ability to have internal control or self-control for the child. It is of utmost importance that the parent never make a practice of doing anything for the child that he can do for himself. I should say that 10 times, and it would still be inadequate. I hope you will write that last sentence on a big piece of cardboard and stick it up on your wall. It is of utmost importance that the parent never make a practice of doing anything for the child that he can do for himself. If your child is 5 years old and is not tying his shoes, if he's 4 years old and mommy is still putting the spoon in his mouth to feed little Johnny, if he is 6 years old and he still throws his clothes all over the house, then you are making him a cripple. On the other hand, if you teach him to do what he can do as soon as he is able to do it, you will make him a giant. Don't rob your child by thinking falsely that you're serving him and doing him a favor. There are 2 aspects of training that correspond to the 2 periods of the time that he will be under your care. The first period would be up till age 8, 9, 10, and the second period beyond that. The first period, the focus is control. It sounds terrible. But if you've seen those old movies where they're driving down the road and the guy takes the steering wheel and hands it to the other guy, you know, since you're not in the car and since it's just a movie, it's funny. But I would hate to ever have that happen going down the interstate. Control is of utmost importance in our lives. If it were not for controls, we would not be alive today. We would have already been killed on the highway. Control is what keeps your electricity coming at 110 volts or whatever it is. It's the maintaining of stability. It gives security. It means you don't have to live a life filled with anxiety. It means you don't have to be a slave. A child is born without internal control. Now, what's the prerequisite of the parents training their children in control? You said, I knew he was going to get to this. The parents have to be self-controlled. Yes, we'll move right on. We won't stay on it. The child has to learn obedience. He is naturally rebellious. The parent has to establish himself as the authority over the child. The parent has the right and the responsibility to guide the child. The child is not an adult. The family is not a democracy. We all have one vote. There are four kids, two adults. It's 4-2, no more vegetables. It is not a democracy. The parents have the right and the responsibility. They will answer to God one day for why did your child die of malnutrition? OD'd on candy bars. For 3 years had not even seen a green vegetable because you had run your home as a democracy. The child needs for the parent to maintain sufficient control in order that he himself will not become a total slave to his sinful nature. We'll talk about that more in a minute. The second area, from like age 10 on through age 18, is the area of teaching. Teaching, because the child's mind is now developed. Let's talk about what's the prerequisite. Again, one of those unfortunate phrases, the prerequisite of being able to teach your child is that you, as a parent, are still learning. You must model whatever you want your child to learn. And if it's in this area of receiving teaching, then you need to be the type of a person who's receiving teaching. But you're already ahead on that because you're here this morning. The parents should not control their children externally for more time than is necessary. As soon as the child demonstrates complete obedience under phase one, he should then be instructed to the degree that he can understand. I want you to understand where we're going with this because it's a very logical progression. The first stage, pointer here. The first stage is control supplied externally by the parents. The focus is that the child obey. But Mom, I don't understand. For right now, you don't need to understand. You're only 3 years old. It's a little beyond you. Just do what Mom and Dad say. But this is limited in its effectiveness. It's very important to have that here. If you don't have this here, then you'll never get to this. It will just be civil war here. Schism, strife, and maybe somebody's demise. But if you have established control here, and the child has seen and experienced what it is to walk in righteousness, to be a learner, to be obedient, then they can learn to be a self-starter in that. The focus here is not obedience, although if they learned it here, then they will be obedient here. But the focus here is more their attitude of honoring their parents, because that is what prepares them to be an adult. Blind obedience in the second phase only hurts them. Why? Because you're not going to be around always to tell them what to do. And worse than that, you don't even know half the time what's best for them to do. They're living in a completely different world than you grew up in. And if they follow, when they're 25 years old, everything you say, they're in a heap of trouble. They have to learn to live their life without you. So, at the beginning, the control is very high. but it's with the idea that it will then drop off. It's very sad to see people reverse this. In the young years, it's teaching. Well, let mommy explain it to you. Now, would you like to do it? No. Well, let me give you a couple of other good reasons why you're trying to do the teaching at this point. When all they know is they want to do what they want to do and they don't care about all these words. But then the child becomes an adolescent. And all this teaching, of course, it never worked. But now they're terrified. Drugs. They're going to get pregnant. They're going to get beaten up, killed, mugged. They're going to get in a gang. Control. Chain them to their room. Mark Twain said, when a boy reaches 13 years old, you just put them in a barrel, nail the lid on, and feed them through the little hole. And when they reach the age of 16, you just plug up the hole. Very important to get these in the right order. In the first phase of control, there's a focus on external control coming from the parents. In it, they communicate what the child must do and not do. It is not a democracy. It is an imposed conformity. Most of the time at the beginning, they will not be in agreement with you. But you are under God's authority to be their authority. And it's okay that they don't agree and don't understand sometimes. As long as you are doing it out of a heart of love that you have received from God, then in time it will bear its proper fruit. Just think of all the things you didn't agree with on your parents. And now you think, you know what? They weren't so wrong after all.
But it's also, I don't know if we can go to this later, but it's also very important in the control area to not abuse it and exasperate your child, which the scriptures also talk about.
Very good. Thank you. In the teaching phase, you shift. There you're focusing on the development of internal control within the child. They should need less and less for you to tell them, less and less for you to control them and make them do what they ought to do. And more because of the teaching and the development of their own mind and character, they will naturally tell the truth, work hard, respect others, help the helpless. Here you focus a whole lot more on giving them the reasons behind the rules. You communicate, I trust your decisions. You pray about it. What is God telling you to do in this situation? I'm not going to make you do it. You can choose to do it. Because that's what they'll do the rest of their lives. And it's more and more of a voluntary submission. I'd like to mention and give thanks for the Lord using this particular book. It's called What the Bible Says About Child Training. I'd have to add that, as with any book, I wouldn't say that I necessarily agree with all of it, but you're going to have your own philosophy. You know, these are just different ideas and things that have helped us and that we've received. But I'd like to recommend this book. Many of the concepts, the terms like control and training, I got out of this book, and it's in your handout. I put the address and the phone number where you can order it. It's only like $7. And it would be a good thing to have in your library and to read. Let's move on to the second point.
If you'd like to turn to chapter 2, page 1, we'll start talking about love and justice and the problem of the pendulum.
We obviously need to strike a balance, as you know, and there is the problem of the pendulum. Sometimes if you were, as a child, were disciplined very severely, then as an adult, you will tend to probably either discipline severely or go to the other extreme and say, well, that was terrible what my parents did to me. I'm not going to be that way. And you go to the other extreme of permissiveness with just occasional swing back because they get to be so horrible in their behavior that you just explode. And then you sheepishly come back to being permissive again until you can't stand anymore. You explode and then you go back still feeling guilty. And the child wondering what in the world is going on. I'm living with a time bomb. Children need the discipline of their parents, but with much love. It needs to be in the middle. They need the firmness, but they need the comfort. They need the steel. They need the velvet. It's not either or. If it were not for steel, you would all be sitting on the floor right now. Don't reject the firmness. With our lives, it's a good thing there are a lot of firm things. Can you imagine trying to drive down the interstate in a car made of foam rubber? It just wouldn't do you any good. But on the other hand, you wouldn't want to drive to Savannah or Myrtle Beach in something made completely out of metal. It doesn't wear well. You need both the love and the justice and that balance. And we want to teach you this morning some principles about how to keep that balance. And what is that balance? Our children must be a priority. Now, you would never get this wrong on a test. I realize I'm repeating something that you would say to anybody. But in the Old Testament, there was one of the gods that was worshipped, a false god called Moloch. Now, this was a large metal statue with arms held out like this, and they would kindle a fire in it and heat it up red hot, and they would sacrifice their children on it. They would lay a little baby on its arms, and it would burn to death there. Others say the arms were sloping down and there was a fire pit there. They would place the arm in that, and as the child moved around, it would finally fall off into the fire. And that was what their children passing through fire is the term used for it in Jeremiah. And God hates child sacrifice. You say, what does this have to do with us? We are not to sacrifice our children to any false god. Work, materialism, personal comfort, etc. The kingdom of God belongs to them. What is it that has your heart? Does your child have a big enough place in your heart? Is there something of lesser importance that you are allowing to steal your child's rightful place in your heart? Because in 20 years, it'll all be over. But the shouting. This is your chance. We have a little skit we're going to try and put on for you with no rehearsal. We just have it written out here, but we want to illustrate something. The key difficulty that a child has, and as a result that you will face, is rebellion. If the child were a perfectly logical creature, already an adult and wise beyond their years, then you could just deal with them as an adult. Of course, that has its own problems, doesn't it? You're married to an adult, you thought. But there's an added element with this little one of an unrefined and raw rebellious nature. And there are different ways that nature reveals itself. We want to act it out for you. If you can't relate to this at all, that's fine. But you will probably have at least seen manifestations of this before. If not in your home, in the home of others, in the Sunday school, etc.
Goodbye, sweetheart. See you later.
Bye.
Where's Dad going? I want to go too.
He's not going anywhere. He'll be right back.
What do you mean nowhere, Mommy? He is too going somewhere, and I'm going with him. Wait, Dad, I'll put on my shoes.
I'm sorry, honey, but you can't go.
Hey, Dad, wait up.
Come here, Susie.
No!
Susie, come here. I said come here, and I'll not say it again. Now, come here, or I'll send you to your room. Susie, look at me. Look at me. Look at me. Listen, honey, let me explain. It's like this.
I don't care. I still want to go.
Sweetie, you want to call Granddaddy? You've been wanting to call your Granddaddy.
No, I want to go with Daddy.
Hey, I've got an idea. If you'll be good, maybe we can go to McDonald's for lunch, okay?
I want to go.
What are the neighbors going to think if you keep acting like this?
I don't care.
Please, Susie, be a good girl. Be sweet for Mommy.
No.
That is enough. I have had it with you. You are always so bad. You're such a pain, you little brat. I don't have to put up with this. You're grounded for the rest of the weekend. Oh, she's just a strong-willed child.
Now, I'm glad you can't relate to that. But I was wondering, as we went through it, what were different ways that Johnny demonstrated rebellion? What? Not listening? Okay. With what sort of an attitude? Disrespectful. What else? Physical resistance.
Violence or
fit. Okay, throwing a fit with a smaller child. When we've done it for age 3, I throw myself on the floor and she yanks me up by my hair, you know. That's more for Argentina. It's contextualized. All right, well, let's take a look here at rebellion. What is rebellion? Rebellion is the voluntary rejection of authority and can be expressed actively or passively. Parents need to learn to recognize the ways that their children express rebellion and how to handle a situation when it happens. Sounds so calm and collected, doesn't it? You can normally see rebellion in the first year between 6 and 10 months. We're not talking about starting around age five. As you know, it's surprising how early in life you can tell that they know and they are resisting you. Don't roll around on the changing table. I told you not to roll around on the changing table. You have a, you know, and we have to get you cleaned. That happened with Walt at what age?
Well, 6 or 7 months.
Yeah, it happens very, very relatively early. You know, in the very first year, you begin to see the tiny little first indications of rebellion. At that point, they're so small. I mean, you just hold them still or whatever. But those days come to an end soon. In general, they overlook it. Parents overlook it in the first months, obligating the child to obey by physical force. But after 12 years or less, there is no longer that option. That's no longer a viable option. This way of dealing with rebellion becomes less and less effective as the child increases in size and strength, just making them do what you want them to do because you're bigger than them. Like when they're 10 inches taller than you and 50 pounds heavier than you. She could not have done that to me if I were a 16-year-old. See, she could walk over there, grab me by the arm, pull me over here because I was only 7 years old. If she doesn't figure out another way to handle a situation, her days are numbered as an influence in the child's life. So how does... We need to learn to recognize rebellion. We already mentioned these. He ignored the instructions. He said no. He defiantly walked away. Wouldn't look at her. Remember, she said, look me in the eyes. And I wouldn't do that. Refuses to say yes, sir. I didn't ever respond to her verbally. Not only did I say no, you know, but I didn't say yes, ma'am. Far from it. You know, you weren't even thinking about that. You know, so far the other extreme. Throws a fit, refuses correction, verbal or physical, and or physical. Continuously forgets instructions or chooses not to remember. And the passive form, where the child outwardly conforms, but inwardly are still stewing. I'm sitting down on the outside, but I'm still standing up on the inside. That defiance. You're big enough to make me do it now. But I'm growing. Demonstrated in attitudes of anger and distrust. But one thing maybe that wasn't as clear to us is what was going on with the mother. Because everything that child did, listen to me, everything that child did, he was trained to do by none other than the parents. The parent is only reaping at that point with a 7-year-old exactly, no more, no less than what he has sown. He is not a problem child. He has a problem parent. Let's take a look at that dreadful reality. Why? Because there are wrong ways of dealing with rebellion. There are wrong ways of dealing with just about any calamity in life. You have a fire going on in your garage. You run to the gallon of what of container that you thought had water in it. Cast it on this flame, only to your horror to realize you threw gasoline on the fire. Thinking you were solving the solution, the situation, you only made it worse. The same is true in dealing with rebellion. There are things that parents are doing, thinking this is the way out. This is the way we're going to handle. This will help things. And they're only dumping gasoline on the fire. The first approach, when we did this in Argentina, I had somebody else be Johnny. And at this point, we had them go back through the skit. And at each point where the mother responded wrongly to rebellion, we stopped it and named what it was she was doing. So let's look back at the skit. We can't do it quite as graphically as that. But let's look again at what the mother is saying. We notice it's more noticeable what the child is doing, right? You think the mother's just trying to cope. Poor thing. It's this beast that's related to her somehow. Johnny, where's Dad going? I want to go too. Mother, nowhere really. He'll be right back. Later on, she tells him, no, he's going to a meeting. Remember that part? What's that called? Deception. She lied to him. Come here, John. No. I said come here, and I'll not say it again. Which he proceeds to say several more times. Now come here, or I'll send you to your room. Did Johnny ever go to his room? That's making empty threats. That's being a windbag. Children are not stupid. When they realize that you say 40 times more than what you'll ever carry out, do you think they're going to take you seriously? So Johnny walks off. She gets him, and then she says, listen, honey, let me explain. It's like this. When a police officer pulls you over for going 95 miles an hour, does he come up to you and say, now don't get mad. Let me just explain the situation. We have laws in this land. You know, he would be making fun of you if he did that. He is an authority figure. And he relates to you at that point of your infraction as an authority figure. Not as a one-on-one, well, what do you think about this? You know, what do you think about the idea of giving tickets, you know? And or maybe you would just like to choose to repent and drive the speed limit. Reasoning. I don't care. I still want to go. Sweetie, you wanted to call Granddaddy. Would you like to give him a call long distance and talk with him? What's that? That's distraction. Hey, look over here. To try and break their concentration on this thing they want. Instead of dealing with that rebellion, we just try to distract, change the subject. No, I want to go with Daddy. Hey, I've got an idea, says Mom. Creative Mom. If you'll be good, maybe we can go to McDonald's for lunch. Where do you think graft and corruption and bribery start in the government? It started in the playpen. If you'll be good for Mom, Mom will give you a candy. When they're 30 years old, they don't want candy. They want money, power, and a whole lot of other things. Don't train your child to live for bribes. He starts to cry. Mother says, what are all these people going to think if you keep acting like this? We'll talk about that a little more. That's manipulation of the child's sinful nature. His pride. Okay, we've got one problem, rebellion. But I know he has a weakness in the area of pride. He cares about what other people think because he's my child and I care about what other people think about me. So I say, oh, isn't this going to be embarrassing if everybody else sees you? So he gets into high school. And what? He's worried about what everybody else thinks. He's on drugs now because he was worried about what everyone else thinks. Why is he worried about what everyone else thinks? His mom taught him to be worried about what everyone else thinks. What's everybody going to say? There are things that you can do to deal with discipline that although you might win this little skirmish here, you are setting them up for tremendous failure later on. Because to deal with one sinful desire, you build up another sinful desire. You fan that to flame. So that by raising up another stronger sinful desire, you get them to do, comply with what you wanted to in this other area. This is terrible, isn't it? Johnny, I don't care. Starts crying louder. Mother, pleading, please, Johnny, be a good boy. Be sweet for mommy. Authority figures never ask or beg and retain their authority. The drill sergeant on Paris Island that starts saying, please, please, think about me. Look at my life. Won't you please march in step? Has completely lost it and will soon not have a job. He throws a fit, knocks over the chair. Mother gets mad. Do moms ever get mad? That's enough. I've had it with you. Why are you always so bad? It's because she doesn't believe in hurting her child. She doesn't believe in hurting her child. My friend, words go deeper, scar longer than any little blow with a little instrument on a part of the body that can take much worse blows. There are things that you remember that were said to you when you were 6, 7, and 8 years old, that at the same period of time, you cannot even remember if there was a discipline issue, and there probably was, where your parent probably disciplined you physically. You can't remember that, but you remember those words. They have burned in your mind ever since. You little brat. You'll never amount to anything. Why were you ever born? Why do I have to put up with you? Why can't you be like your little brother? Why can't you be good? Verbal abuse. And finally, the mother says, you're grounded for the rest of the weekend. 7 years old. Where was he going to go anyway? And then finally she says, he's just a strong-willed child. Like, there's really nothing you can do about it anyway. Friends, that is not true. He acts that way because we train him to be that way. I don't think I'll go over all of these because I've kind of gone over them briefly here. But do you understand what this idea of rebellion is? Do you understand what this idea of rebellion is? We're making a distinction here between rebellion and disobedience. What's the difference? Everybody's thinking. Rebellion is specifically related to authority. Right there. It's the authority says this, and I say something different. I am not submissive. I'm not ordering myself under the authority. I'm trying to set myself up as my own authority. I'm in rebellion. Disobedience is when there's a general rule. You're supposed to clean up your room every morning. And it's not as though Dad was standing there watching you or Mom was watching you and you said, no, I'm not going to clean up my room. It's just that you just sort of forgot. And it's just getting messier and messier. That's more the idea of disobedience. It's apart from the parent. It's related to the thing in itself. A child who is rebellious is reacting not so much because of the issue involved. There are times when a child will do something they normally would not even want to do. But it's their way of showing that you are not in charge. So even though they didn't really even care to go with Dad, who cares about Dad? I just don't want Mom telling me what to do. That's rebellion. Disobedience is more related to the thing itself. So they're sitting there by themselves. They know they're supposed to eat their vegetables. They just don't like vegetables. And so they start hiding those vegetables, you know, under the table. I once had a big wax thumb you could put over your thumb like this. And I found with a toothpick I could cut the thumbnail out and stuff vegetables in there. I'd take the thumbnail off, stick vegetables in there, and put the thumbnail back on. You know, there are all these things. Thomas was telling me of something he did the other day, long ago. He'd never confessed it, you know, somewhere where his vegetables had ended up. That's disobedience. But that's where they're kind of hiding it. It's not an open display of defiance toward authority. So what we're first talking about is the attitude of rebellion. the attitude of rebellion. And these are the wrong ways of dealing with it. The first step is they do what is right, whether they want to or not, whether they feel it or not, whether they feel remorse or not. You're placing their feet in the path of righteousness. Because it's like when you learn to play an instrument, at the beginning, you don't feel it. You think, I feel spastic trying to put my fingers here and do this and then do this. And it's complicated. This will never come to me naturally. But as you continue to practice and do it, then you learn a freedom in it, as I have now with the guitar. My boys are trying to learn the guitar, and it's so slow, and, oh, my fingers won't do it. Your fingers will do it. They just have to learn to do it. And those little feet of your children need to be placed in the path of righteousness, even when they don't feel it, so that they, by walking in the path of righteousness, will get a feel for what it, oh, yeah, I guess I can do that. At first, they do it because they have to do it. Because you, as their authority, you make them do it by different means. But as time goes on and they see receive the blessings of walking in righteousness, of respect, obedience, reconciliation, loving one another, it catches on. It's a wonderful life, walking in the way of the Lord. And they become preachers of it. Thomas, when he was 7 years old, at school, there was one kid, there always is, who was really a beast above all the other beasts. And Thomas one day sidled up to him and he said, was his name Chad? Chad. See, I still remember. This is several years later. Chad, does your dad spank you? Chad said, no. Thomas said, I didn't think he did. He said, you really ought to tell him to give that a try. It certainly is a help. To help you do what's good. Righteousness is its own reward.
If you'd now like to turn to chapter 3, page 1, we're going to talk about the issue of control.
We're going to talk about, in more greater depth, the issue of control. I think a good example of this is the area of diapers. Anybody that's had children can relate to diapers. Now, in Argentina, we used cloth diapers because Costa Rica, because when Walt was born, and the Pampers down there were about $2 a shot per Pamper. So, who has that kind of money? And I won't go into all the details, but we learned a lot about diapers since our house was without running water from 7:30 in the morning till 7 at night. And you know what happens with diapers when you have to reuse them. They need to be ministered to in the meanwhile. We must provide control for a child physically in the area of their bowel movements. The parent, they're two extremes on the issue of diapers. The parents that say, we're going au natural, or whatever you say. Diapers is an artificial thing. If God had meant children to have diapers, He would have made diaper trees. And so this whole idea of manufacturing diapers and this whole industry that's grown up around diapers, we just reject that. We believe in a more natural approach. And we believe that this human being is fully capable. We just need to believe in him. No diapers. And that has many consequences. No one will want to hold your child. Your house will smell a very particular way. Your car. It will affect everything in your life and your whole wardrobe if you choose to go the no diapers route. The other extreme is diapers for life. Man, my son is 45, and I'm very proud to say that he, 24 hours a day, is clean and dry with his Pampers. I mean, we have to get elephant-sized Pampers now because he's a grown man. But I'm just very pleased he's in no danger of accidents. Don't hesitate to let him sit on your couch because he is protected, and so you are too. There are two extremes in the issue of control of a child's bowel movements. But what is so clear to us in this area of control, in the physical way, we realize diapers, praise the Lord, is a temporary arrangement. It is only to be as long as the child needs it. It is always with the vision of not always having to put diapers on the child. So that while the child is incapable of controlling himself, use the diapers. As soon as he's able to graduate and take care of his needs in an adult way, and it's such a thing of pride for the little child, isn't it? You know, they go around telling everybody all the details of where they did it and how it went. And now they can spend the whole night without a diaper on. It's just almost like a cap and gown graduation ceremony. The same way in the issue of control and helping a child to do what's right, it's always with the idea, this is temporary. The vision of me of imposing a control on him is always that he will eventually not need it. That is the purpose of imposing the control now. To give him enough of a taste of what it's like to live a controlled life so that he can do it for himself as soon as possible in every area of his life. The same thing is true with a cast. You might want to just jot this down because this is not in your notes. But friends, a rubber cast is of no good when you break your arm. If that cast is flexible, your bone will never heal. Your pain will never stop. A cast is only good if it is rigid. But who wants to wear a cast the rest of their lives? How many people have had a cast on, by the way? Anybody ever had a cast on? Wow! What a healthy group. Well, you can't relate to that then. You can relate to diapers, though. But the idea of a cast always is that it will eventually not be needed. Friends, you haven't had a cast, but casts, with time, get very smelly. You try to impose a strict control on your child forever, and it will smell. It will be a sorrow to the community. You will be the only one that doesn't realize. Your child will realize. They will go through life embarrassed. Mom is still telling me what color socks I should wear. She's 85. I'm 60. But she calls me every day to tell me what I should put on. Everybody will be embarrassed for you. It's always with the idea that it is temporary and it is to obtain a higher level of control. Children need control. They need control in what and when to eat, when to sleep. Your child should not be deciding what time is his bedtime. I don't want to go to bed. I want to watch another hour of this terrible television programming. What clothing to wear. I don't want to wear any clothes today. How to act in different situations, social situations. What is allowed to influence them? Well, he wanted to, so I had to let him do it. Is a very common phrase in Argentina. He wanted to watch that TV show. He wanted to be with his friends. He didn't want to eat his vegetables, as though the parent were tied up with chains and shackles to the will of this 3-foot-tall midget. He needs control in what attitudes he should have. If your child is disrespectful, ungrateful, lazy, it is because you haven't provided him with a high enough level of control to be any different than the way he was born. Let's define control. It's the use of power, of force or pressure sufficient to cause a child to follow parental directions. Looking at the drawing here, it's explained in words also. This heavy line is the path of righteousness. Don't you feel a whole lot better when you do what's right? You do. You just, when you've gone the whole day doing what you ought to do, you feel good. Friends, your child is the same way. When your child does what is right, they also receive incredible blessings from God. Have you ever looked at the book of Proverbs and all the blessings that fall on the righteous person? That's not just the righteous adult. That's the righteous child too. So you give your child an advance pressure by saying, I want you to do this, 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 and this. Not how about would you like to consider telling the truth, making your bed. But Mom says, thou shalt make thy bed. not slap your grandmother, be nice to the dog. You define the path of righteousness. How in the world is he going to know where it is if you don't tell him? Instruction. That's the advanced pressure or the anterior or previous pressure. That nothing has gone wrong yet. You're instructing him. He hadn't blown it yet. And you're giving him the opportunity by pointing out, this is the path. Walk in it. That if he chooses to walk in it, and to the degree he chooses to walk in it, everything's fine. But you've reproduced after your own kind, unfortunately. And this child also is like you, in that knowing what is right, they often don't do it. So he diverts from the path in disobedience. So once this disobedience has happened, there's another part of control, a rear pressure of discipline, where you are trying to correct him and get him back on the path of righteousness. That's the point of this. Please, please, wipe from your mind the idea that the discipline process is a process of punishment, of retribution, of repayment. What is the wages of sin? Death. The only appropriate response to sin is an eternity in hell. And we are not equipped to administer that. We would send ourselves at the same time to everlasting torment. Our role as a parent is not to give him what he deserves. I don't want what I deserve. We shouldn't think we're giving him what they deserve. We are extending grace, and we're trying to help a sinner live in victory. We're not trying to pay back a criminal for his crimes against society. And that's why we're choosing to use the word discipline rather than punishment. All right? A question? It's a proper expression of love toward a child. When is this control necessary? Now, don't forget, there are the two. What are the two parts of control that we've talked about? In the little diagram? Instruction. And discipline. Okay? One, before anything's gone wrong. Where there's no law, there's no sin. You didn't tell him to make up his bed. How was he supposed to know? So how can you discipline him for that? There's the before and the after. Fore and aft. You must learn to give good instructions. Show them the path of life. Talk to them nicely. Ahead of time. Too often as parents we assume that any idiot would realize that when you go to somebody's house, you behave this way. Well, whoever told this little idiot created an error image that they were supposed to act that way? He's never read Ann Landers. Yes?
You know, Henry, in this area of punishment, when Brian is disobedient, we teach him that there are consequences to his actions.
Yes, now that is true.
Tell him you are going to be punished because of what you did, and we explain it all, and he gets the punishment. So are you saying that we should not even use that word, you're going to be punished?
I'm talking more in terms of your spirit. If in your spirit you are thinking and therefore communicating, I'm going to pay you back. If it is a spirit of revenge, you are building something in your child's life that is not correct. We want to communicate grace. We want to communicate sorrow over sin. But true retribution for sin is much more than a little spanking. It's much more than being grounded. It's much more than the natural consequences of your sin. The natural consequence of sinning against God and the government by driving with an expired driver's license, the natural consequence of that is to have my license revoked. But if it truly was a sin to disobey willfully the government, if it was also sin against God to do that, the true punishment for that sin is hell, not having my license revoked. So there's a distinction between natural consequences and true punishment and retribution for sin. We want to teach them that there are natural consequences, and when you choose to get off the path of righteousness, you will not receive the blessings of righteousness.
Wouldn't it be that you'd want to teach them that even if you don't receive consequences, you want to do the right thing?
Yes.
I learned if I wasn't punished, I could get away with it, and it was okay.
Right. You want them to learn to do what's right, ultimately, because it is right, not just because there are consequences. Although that in teaching, we won't get to that today, but what you just said, Laurie, is the key element in the area of teaching. Once you've established, once rebellion is conquered, they're under control, and you're dealing more in the area of teaching, and they're older, and you're giving them the reasons. The reasons you're giving them, in many cases, is you're explaining the consequences, because they don't have enough experience to know by experience what are the consequences of being strung out on drugs for 20 years. I mean, they're just 12 years old. They don't know what all the consequences of lust and premarital sex. So you inform them, and then when they choose to do what is wrong, having been instructed, then you also refuse to shield them from the consequences. You want them to feel what it's like to taste how bitter it is to depart from the Lord. Now, obviously, there are times when the consequences are so great, you'll step in to try to, you know, so you'll have somebody still to work with. But in general, you don't want to shield your child from the natural consequences of bad choices. So you're really tracking there. But we still want to make a distinction between the idea of punishment. Why? Because who has the child offended? You. Who's going to be the maddest? You. If you have the idea of punishment, you're going to be out of control. You can only reproduce in your child what they see in you. If they see a parent who always disciplines them, angry, out of control, using physical violence and verbal abuse, then what happens when they get big enough to do it with their little brother? You're going to get it now, John. Mom's not here. Now I'm the big one. Don't abuse your size. We often will use estrangement and distance to really make them pay, because they made me as a parent suffer. They made me look bad. And I want them to really feel this. There are parents that won't hug their child for 2 days, won't speak to them for several hours. They prolong the agony of it. Is that how God is with us? If you confess your sins, He is faithful and just to forgive us our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. The picture of the father, the prodigal son, he allowed the son to suffer the consequences of his decisions. But as soon as that son came to himself and returned, he didn't say, "Up, you're going to have to be a slave. You're going to have to pay for this. I mean, we're not just going to let you walk in here like nothing ever happened." We need to learn to be like God. If God, being perfect, can be gracious, how much more do we need to be gracious? He was gracious with us. And so our goal needs to be not to pay back the criminal, but to help the sinner. All right. Sorry, getting to preaching here. When is it necessary? When is the issue of control necessary? The parent must never allow a child to be tested beyond his ability to comprehend exactly what is off limits. You would not put a pair of scissors in a child's playpen and expect him not to play with them. "I'm going to spank you if you play with these scissors now." He's only 6 months old. Likewise, you do not subject your children at any age to tests for which the consequences of failure are too severe for the lesson learned. You try to limit the difficulty of the situations they're going to be in. A 13-year-old being with a certain crowd at a certain time of night in a certain place, no matter how well they've been trained, there are situations that a person could get into that are just beyond them. And thank God, our Father has often protected us by not allowing us to be in certain situations. We need to remember that with our children. Even parents of a teenager must continue to provide some controls for things that are beyond their ability to explain to the child. What is the immediate result of loving your child enough to provide this control? Attempting to control your child will inevitably produce conflict. Most normal people do not enjoy conflict and would prefer to avoid it at almost any cost. As a parent, you must overcome this natural tendency for the sake of your child. You can feel it coming. You know Johnny wants to do this. You know he should not do that. You know, when you tell him that, he is going to get very angry. Who knows what he will do in his anger? You think, well, is there some other way? I just don't want to deal with this. Conflict. Why do we have to have conflict in our home? It is inevitable. It is part of the control process. It is the pathway. It is the trial that you must pass through in order to gain the control and the respect for authority that that child needs. Steel yourself. We will pass through conflict. If the child wins in the conflict, we both lose. For his sake, I must win at this point in his life, in the first 10 years, so that he will know what it is like to submit to authority. Someday, he will need to submit directly to God's authority, directly to his church authorities, and directly to his authorities at work. He must learn early in life, what does it look like? What does it feel like to, when I want to do something, my authority says, no, stop and accept that. There will be conflict at first. Yes, Debbie.
Don't you think, too, that before you make these situations, we can't waver in what our decision is? I mean, so often we're like, we're not sure, so we approach our children, and then we're like, well, maybe it wasn't the best idea. And they start, no.
Right. You need to know when to be firm. And when not. You make these big pronouncements. I'm not going to tell you again. I said I'm not going to tell you again. I'm going to make you go to your room. Yeah. You have to be much more careful. When you are always going to follow through on what you say, you must be much more careful in what you say.
What scares me to always be right. That's a big problem with my mom. She was always right. And
yeah.
Even when she was wrong, she would never. I
we do not have to always be right. Our child will not always be right. It does not serve him a bit to have an authority that's always right. Part of our service to that child is the times we blow it and admit it. Your child does not need you to always be right. Praise God. He does need you to always be honest. Unless you want to produce a liar. You will reproduce in your child what you are. Are you dishonest? Are you lazy? Are you disorderly? Are you disrespectful? Do you complain about your church? Do you complain about your pastor? Your child is a reflection.
Don't say why. Well, in every area, that'll grow changing, not just when they're 10 years old. I mean, our Caroline, who's 5, has learned complete obedience, that when I say something, that means you do it. So at this point, she is allowed, she has the privilege of asking, well, is it okay if, you know, or she can ask a why to me, because she's learned obedience. So, I mean, in some ways, some things don't have to wait for 10 years. Some years, in some situations, you'll be given teaching and reasons to a 5-year-old, because at 3, they learn to do just what mom said. But the main thing is that they learn that complete obedience first, and then they have the privilege of knowing the reasons behind the why, and because they are going to obey no matter what. We're not saying, no, you just do it, and we're not explaining anything. Now, that comes with each situation, you know, depends on the years.
In the first 8 years or so, when you have not yet, if you have not yet established control, the main reason behind a child's questions is rebellion. They're not that interested in knowing all of the whys of the universe. They just want to get out of doing what you want them to do, and they want to do what they want to do. So they know how to stall. Well, yeah, but why? I mean, they're going to forget as soon as you say it, why. But they just know they gained 10 seconds of liberty. You know, anything they can gain like that. You said, do it now. And if they can make you wait and they don't have to do it for another 30 seconds, then they gained it. They won a little bit. They got a few points scored. Because even though they eventually had to do it, they said, well, I did it, but I did it when I wanted to. And all this stuff, they're not thinking this necessarily unconsciously. It's just the way we are as sinners. We want to get as much as we can of our will in there. Even if they make us do this, well, we'll do it in our way and in our time. Why is it This is the $10 question. Why is it that children desire limits, because they really do, but at the same time fight against them? Doesn't that sound like a contradiction? You've seen the thing where it says, oh, no, please. I don't care for any flattery. Don't praise me. Well, it's the same thing with limits. Children want limits. The most miserable children are the ones that have no limits, that get anything they want whenever they want it. The solution lies in the similarities between childhood and adulthood. When we finish this page, we'll take a break. Adults fight against any external attempt, diet, good advice, conscience, to restrict their own wants. But after they indulge themselves, they wish someone would have stopped them. Why did I eat the whole thing? It could have stayed in the refrigerator for another 3 days, and everyone could have shared in it, and I ate it all at 3 a.m. The dichotomy between the desire for autonomy during temptation and the longing for controls after it is too late is simply a fact of human nature. Isn't that good? This comes out of that book, by the way. Another plug for the book. It is difficult enough for adults to exercise self-control. Adults have already experienced harmful results from doing what was not good for them. And yet they still have difficulty in preventing future reoccurrences of the error. It is ridiculous to expect children to control themselves in order to avoid future consequences they have never experienced. Expecting a child to brush his teeth well because of the threat of tooth decay and tooth loss is unrealistic. In the early years, parents must control the child so that he will do what they know is right for him in the long run. Parents would be naive to expect their children to receive their instructions with joy in their hearts and smiles on their faces. You must eat your vegetables. Oh, thank you, Mother. I was just waiting for the instruction. The child's natural inclination towards self-centeredness will be in opposition to many parental controls. He can be expected to lust for sweets and junk food while rejecting foods that are good for him. He will strongly desire to be the center of attention. He can be expected to consider his own play and entertainment more important than anything his parents might want him to do, such as sleep, dress, eat, take a bath, or go to the bathroom. When parents interfere with their child's selfish and perpetual pursuit of happiness, conflict will be the result.
If you'd now like to turn to chapter 4, we're going to look at how to deal with rebellion.
We won't stop to read it now, but at the beginning of this handout is the longest passage and maybe the best passage on discipline, the way God deals with us, the importance of discipline. Look at verse 11. Hebrews 12, 4 through 13, looking at verse 11. All discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful. We were talking about conflict. But sorrowful. Yet to those who have been trained by it, by discipline, afterwards it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. Many times we don't much like the process, but we like the product. Many times when you were in school, you thought, ugh, this is terrible. But you were very glad that you have finished whatever level of education you finished. Afterwards, it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. I want to take look at an overview of child training. We've already talked about it. We're just looking at the same thing again. Remember, there was control in the first 10 years or so, teaching in the second 10 years or so. Every child is different. We're speaking sort of in generalities. But before you can adequately teach a child, they must be under control. If your child is still rebellious, he will not sit still to listen to you lecture to him. If your child is under authority, then you are ushered into a whole new level of being able to help him understand life and be prepared to deal with it. In the first column, we've got the parents' goals, control and teaching. When the parent starts to seek this objective of control, the result of that is conflict, the conflict of rebellion. And the response of the parent needs to be physical discipline. In the second 10 years, the objective of the parent is teaching. There will be times when the child will not live up to that teaching, not because of directly defying your authority, but just because of human frailty. And the parent's response to that needs to be in the area of consequences, as Laurie had mentioned before. Allowing them, helping them to suffer the natural consequences, not because that pays for their sin. It does not. But because it helps them to learn that sin, that crime, does not pay. Let's talk about some of the possibilities when it comes to physical discipline. I believe there are many parents today who think the spirit of the age is physical discipline is wrong. We are a civilized